Good morning. It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. Well, it's the end of the year and time for reviewing the past year, the past decade. You get it. Most of these reviews tend to focus on things like best of, top stories, most popular. Well, we're going to take a slightly different approach this morning. Oh, it'll be a top stories approach, but this time it won't be the top stories you saw in 2009, but the top stories you missed over the past year. Probably missed. Well, there's always a curve wrecker out there somewhere. Foreign Policy magazine recently published its special end-of-the-year edition, and among the articles was one titled Top 10 Stories You Missed in 2009. Joining me to talk about these stories is Josh Keating, associate editor of Foreign Policy magazine and author of the piece Top 10 Stories You Missed in 2009. Josh Keating, good morning and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, before we go into the list, and we may not get to all 10, they're all pretty interesting, how does a story make the list?
Well, the idea behind the list is that these are the stories that were reported, and they all did appear in newspapers, but for some reason didn't become a topic of national conversation and didn't make the transition, as we say, from page A4 of your daily newspaper to the blogosphere and cable news and those outlets that really sort of feed the national conversation. And so what we're doing is taking a look at some of the stories that we think didn't get the attention they deserved and highlighting them. And some of these perhaps will become bigger stories in the coming year.
Well, they're certainly interesting stories. And it's hard to say, I think, sometimes why some stories make it through the clutter and some don't. Why do you think these stories didn't make it into our consciousness, so to speak?
Well, there's only so much time for Sarah Palin news, so sometimes it's hard for other things to get reported. But more seriously, I think that these tend to be stories that are a little more complicated and require a bit more of a look below the surface, beyond the headlines, and may not be as easy to explain quickly. And so they don't make sound bites the way that some other political news stories do. And another reason is just that many news outlets are cutting back on their international coverage. And, of course, this list focuses on international stories. So I think that there's unfortunately, we don't get the kind of in-depth reporting on some international stories that we may be used to as major newspapers cut back.
When I was teaching radio and television news writing, and this is quite a while ago, we used to call those delayed reward stories.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like getting the baseball scores or things like that, stories that made you think they were work, and so maybe we don't look for those as often. Well, let's talk about the stories themselves, and let's start with number one. The Northeast Passage opens for business. I've heard of the fabled Northwest Passage. Is this the same thing?
Well, the Northeast Passage is the sea route above Russia, and for the first time this year, because of the melting of Arctic ice, the area is open to commercial shipping, and there were two German vessels made the voyage this year. And this is an important story for international trade because it cuts down on the routes that were previously used, but it's also obviously a environmental milestone because that ice that once made the passage impassable is now loosening and that area is opening up.
Well, looking at the story, it also there are some implications, kind of some security implications. It looks like Canada has some concerns here as well.
Yeah, well, a Russian expedition literally planted a Russian flag below Arctic ice to stake a claim to the newly accessible natural resources there, and this has really disturbed Canada, which has been holding war games to prepare for a possible military confrontation that might result.
Wow, that's the kind of story we really need to hear about.
Yeah, and actually, in a recent interview with Newsweek, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton identified this as one issue that she doesn't often get asked about, but that she feels is going to be something serious in the next few years. I don't know if she had read the list already, but.
Well, we would expect the Secretary of State to be reasonably well-informed. So, you know, one thing I forgot to do at the beginning of the program, I should do that now, is to give people a chance to get involved in this. If you've got a question about one of these stories or would like to make a comment or an observation, please join us at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. You can also send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Okay, so we have ships passing to the north side of Russia through the Arctic Ocean. That's a very big deal. It could be a huge economic issue, and also might even become a military issue, depending on what happens in the future. So that's number one. Number two, Iraq's new flashpoint. I guess many of us would probably have assumed the whole country was a flashpoint. What's going on there that we should be paying attention to that we're not hearing about?
Well, I do think if there was one broad story that was missed this year, it was Iraq. I think that as the new administration came in and the national security establishment's attention shifted from Iraq to Afghanistan, that the media followed suit. And a lot of the dangers that still remain in Iraq have gone largely unreported. And one of them is this area on the Kurdish border, Nineveh, which the International Crisis Group warns could be a site for future sectarian conflict. There was a hardline Arab Nationalist Party elected there, and the Kurdish party is now boycotting the government, and there have been several truck bombings in Kurdish villages there, and outside experts really worry that this is an area that, if it erupted, could drag down the whole country and reverse a lot of the progress that's been made in recent years.
So, are American policymakers paying attention to this issue, or are they watching it, and we're just not getting the story, or is nobody picking this up?
Well, I think that a reason that it's not getting picked up is because it's not really affecting U.S. troops anymore, because the drawdown is commencing, and there aren't really that many soldiers involved in the area, and I think that for that reason it hasn't been much of an issue for the American media or American policymakers. But as the U.S. troops start to pull out, if the situation is becoming unstable, I think that we're going to see attention shifting back again to Iraq very quickly.
There's a huge potential. This has always been a huge potential for conflict in that area, particularly given the oil resources there, and this is just seems to be getting worse. One of the curious stories here is those of us who grew up in the 50s and 60s remember the famous hotline, the red telephone between the United States and the old Soviet Union. Now I understand there's one between China and India. What's up with that?
Right. Well, another story that's gone largely unnoticed this year is the increasing tensions on the Indian-Chinese border. There's this region called Tawang, which is considered internationally to be part of India, but China claims that it's part of historically part of Tibet and therefore part of China. And they fought a war over this area in 1962, but it's been becoming increasingly militarized in recent years. There have been increasing number of border violations and what they call aggressive border patrolling by Chinese forces. And this year, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and Hu Jintao decided that in order to keep this dispute from leading to a military or even nuclear confrontation, that they would set up a hotline between the two governments to address any problems before they get out of hand. And as you mentioned, this is along the lines of the famous Moscow-Washington red telephone, and China and the United States also have one, as do India and Pakistan.
What's in this area that is of interest to both parties?
Well, this is a largely Buddhist area where the population is very loyal to the Dalai Lama, and actually one of the things that provoked tension this year was that the Dalai Lama visited Tawang, and which was seen as a very provocative act by China, and is some. something that really irritated them.
But I mean, what's there that makes it an attractive area? Are there natural resources there? Is there gold, oil, whatever? I mean, is there anything there other than, and I don't mean this to sound the way it's going to, but other than the people who live there, what's there that that's worth fighting over?
Well, I don't know if it's natural resources. I think it has. It's more to do with the Tibet conflict, and this is a historically Tibetan area that China has since 1962 considered to be part of their territory. And I think that, from what I understand, they just feel it's part of their territory, and they think it was wrongly taken from them and want it back.
Interesting. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about the top 10 stories you missed in 2009. These are international stories mainly. The list was compiled by for Foreign Policy magazine by my guest, Josh Keating, who is associate editor of Foreign Policy magazine and author of the piece that we're discussing this morning. You can join our discussion at any time by calling 800-642-1234 or sending an email to talk@wpr.org. Josh, one of the things I noticed, there was a term you used, and I just wanted you to talk about it a little bit. I found it amusing because I think I know what it is. But when we were talking about Iraq's new flashpoint in your article, you used the term chattering classes. What are those?
Well, by that I mean the editorial writers and bloggers that kind of determine what becomes part of the national conversation and drive a lot of TV coverage. And I think that often stories are reported by wire services or the news media, but they don't get picked up by the chattering classes, as you say, and therefore a lot of people don't hear about them. And it's just a symptom of the way that our media is largely opinion-driven now, that a lot of these stories don't get the attention they deserve.
Is that good or bad, do you think?
I think it is unfortunate. I think that we're getting a picture of international politics that's very driven by personalities and provocative statements, and a lot of these stories, which aren't as personality-driven and maybe require a bit more explaining and research, that they don't really get the attention that they might have.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we have some people who want to join us by phone to talk about the issue of uncovered stories. And I think, Josh, you should be ready. Some people are probably going to call in and have their own suggestions for stories that may or may not have made your list. So
that's
we
great.
may be jumping around a little bit. But we'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll have some people join us in our discussion. There are still lines available for you if you'd like to call in right now, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 21 after 9, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. Gene Purcell is in for Ben Marins. And after 5 o'clock, we'll be talking about language. Nearly half the 7,000 languages spoken in the world today will be extinct within your lifetime. After 5, join Gene Purcell and his guest in a conversation on protecting the knowledge, wisdom, and culture of the world's languages. This hour, we're talking about stories that you missed, international news that you may not have heard about, although given the what I know about the audience at Wisconsin Public Radio, I would be willing to place a small wager that many of our listeners are aware of a number of these stories, maybe not all of them. Anyway, the genesis for this particular program is an article that appears in the most recent edition of Foreign Policy magazine titled "The Stories You Missed in 2009." We have the author of that article with us, Josh Keating, who is also associate editor of Foreign Policy magazine. We have been talking about these stories. There are 10 of them listed in the article. We've gone through three, and we have some callers who want to join us and talk about different international stories that, well, we may have missed and may not even be on the list. Let's take a call first from Dan in La Crosse. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Munson, you briefly mentioned a story some time ago about American people who had money invested in Swiss banks to avoid paying American taxes. And I wish that story could be covered more. Working people, you know, scrape and work to pay their taxes legitimately, and this money is being drained from our treasury. And I just would hope that could be revisited.
All right. Thanks, thanks, Dan. Gosh, if listeners are going to start remembering things I say, I think I could be in trouble. Josh, I remember talking about that. We were discussing another issue on another show I was hosting that has come up before, but we don't get a lot of coverage on that particular issue.
Yeah, well, this year there was a the Europe kind of planned a crackdown on tax havens, which included Switzerland. And if I remember correctly, because of largely Swiss influence, they wound up watering down that planned crackdown to the point where no country was actually defined as a tax haven. And so the whole issue of cracking down on these countries kind of became a non-starter, as I recall.
All right. Well, let's go back to the list, and let's... story number four is titled, A New Housing Bubble. What next?
Right. Well, if you remember, it was speculation. It was largely speculation on the U.S. real estate market that was one of the major precipitating factors of the global financial crisis. And this year, housing prices have actually started rising again, which on the surface may seem like a good thing. But Robert Shiller, who runs one of the main housing pricing index, thinks that he actually sees this as alarming. He thinks that homeowners are getting back into speculation, that bubble thinking might be taking hold again. And the unfortunate thing is that many of the measures that the federal government is taking to address the crisis, such as the Federal Housing Administration underwriting about 2 million mortgages in 2009, may be making the problem worse, because the percentage of these loans that have gone delinquent or in foreclosure has been rising as well.
Is there a geographic component to this bubble? I mean, the last one was driven primarily on the East and West Coast, was it not?
You know, I'm really not sure about that. What I do know is that there's increasing concern about this, and to the point where Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke has said Congress should look into it, and there has been a congressional committee formed to investigate these losses.
Okay. I'm just remembering, because I live in the Midwest, housing prices here didn't go up as much as they did in places like California or, say, Las Vegas, Florida, a lot of places on the East Coast. And so when the bubble burst, didn't cause us quite as much damage in the Midwest as it did in other parts of the country. I'm trying to sell a house right now, so you know, I'm hoping Congress doesn't do anything precipitous until I unload mine. Anyway, a motivated self-interest. We have a caller who I think wants to talk about a story that we've discussed, and let's go back to talking about Kurds in Iraq with June in Shawano. June, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I would like to follow this Kurdish story a little bit, in the sense that it also involves Turkey, and that is that we hear a lot of people, our vice president included, who talk about the eventuality of a Kurdish state. And this has been happening all over the globe as little groups of countries and ethnic groups part from the original state, Yugoslavia and its various parts included. And I'm wondering if this is going to happen, because there are so many people who are, you know, really supportive of this kind of thing, if the Kurds will have a state.
Of course, it's theoretically possible. I think that as a U.S. policy, the idea of an independent Kurdish state has largely been abandoned. You were referring to then-Senator Biden's plan for a three-way division of Iraq, but I think that that idea has largely gone out of favor in the current administration, and I don't think anyone in the U.S. is advocating it anymore. And you mentioned Turkey earlier, and I think that that's a major impediment to Kurdish independence. And so I don't think that the international community involved in Iraq is pushing for Kurdish independence anymore, but that of course, doesn't necessarily mean that it couldn't degenerate on its own.
June, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Dave in Milwaukee next. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. I really like your show. My comment was about, I think, the underreporting of ClimateGate. I don't know. I believe that that should be taken as seriously, and there should be a series of shows and also newspaper and magazine articles, much more should come out with an expert on both pro and con. I really like to hear more about that. And also, I found out that the scientists who originally came up with the concept of this global warming, supposedly, had refuted that story. So I'd like to hear what you say about that.
Well, I might disagree with you that story went underreported. I think that... if you look in the first few days of the conference in Copenhagen, the sponsors themselves were getting up to address the emails that were leaked in the so-called ClimateGate scandal. And I would say that actually, given that most of the data underwriting climate change wasn't really affected by these emails, and it was just one study among many. I would say, if anything, it probably got a little too much coverage. And other stories, such as the first issue we discussed, the fact that the ice is actually melting to the point where ships can travel through the Northeast Passage, I think that that's what's gone unreported, is that businesses and policymakers are already, to a large extent, living in a post-global warming world and adapting to this. So it's interesting that we're still having this debate now, even as this evidence is right in front of us.
Dave, thanks for the call. You could be next if you join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number that's good just about anywhere, although I understand it does not work in Australia. The email address, which works everywhere that the Internet exists, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We're talking about stories, international stories primarily, that you missed in the last year, or you may have missed, or were underreported. You may have some suggestions to add to that list. There certainly were probably more than 10 stories that were important that we didn't hear a lot about because of the way our news is shaped and driven these days. So you're welcome to join us with those suggestions as well. We'll keep talking about the list from this article, and you may want to comment on one of those stories as well. We just got done talking about number four, which is the new housing bubble, renewed speculation in real estate. And that has some people concerned, and there's a congressional committee that's inquiring into this and seeing if there's some federal policy that could be changed to make sure we don't get another crash like the one that we had in the past couple of years. Moving on then to story number five. This one is titled "The Civilian Surge Fizzles," and what's that about?
Well, in November of 2007, U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates delivered a pretty widely noticed speech in which he acknowledged that military success would not be sufficient to win wars like those in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he called for an increased role and increased funding for the State Department and other civilian agencies. And this was a pretty groundbreaking statement from a Secretary of Defense, and it's one that Barack Obama also echoed as he came into the office. The unfortunate thing is that the civilian agencies are really still playing catch-up. Just a month after Obama came in, Gates was asked to identify 300 military personnel to fill jobs in Afghanistan that were intended for civilian experts. And another example is that the Pentagon has been managing the fund designed to boost Pakistan's military capabilities. And because the U.S. doesn't have troops in Pakistan, this is a responsibility that would traditionally fall to the State Department. But it was felt, I guess, that they didn't have the capabilities at the time to manage it. And so the Defense Department has once again been given the larger role. And I think it's been frustrating for people like Gates, who see civilian efforts as an essential part of their counterinsurgency campaign, that the civilian agencies haven't been able to match the plans that they had for them.
And why is that, do you think?
I think a lot of it is lack of funding and just the increased emphasis that we place on the Defense Department in these issues. And I think, and there have been promising signs. There's a plan to deploy about 400 civilians to conflict areas who are being trained right now, and a colleague of mine was just out in a facility in Indiana where they're training civilian officials for duty in Afghanistan.
But what would they be doing again, there?
I'm sorry?
What would they be doing there?
Well, I think in that facility they were training them to operate in conflict areas. I mean, these are civilian personnel, obviously, and they don't have military training, so it's sort of getting them used. They actually set up a kind of mock Afghan village in the middle of Indiana, which is kind of an odd sight. But so I think that largely they're trying to get these people ready, but as State Department officials themselves have acknowledged, they're still really playing catch-up.
But, I mean, what would they be doing when they went to Afghanistan?
Oh, I'm sorry. A lot of it is administering aid on a local level, helping, supporting local governments, and just helping the local population be self-sufficient and not depend on outside aid or the Taliban. And so a large part of the counterinsurgency strategy that the U.S. is employing is not just hard power, but soft power as well, winning hearts and minds. And I think that in order to do that, we need a much larger civilian capability.
I would think it would be a little bit of a challenge to convince people that it was a good idea to go over there.
That's an issue as well. And there was, last year, I guess, there was the whole story of the Foreign Service officers in the State Department that they weren't able to get enough volunteers to go over.
Yeah, I would think they'd have to be offering some pretty good hazard pay to convince anybody to go over there. We have a call, let's see, from Janice in La Crosse. Janice, let's go to you next. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, John, and your guests. I hate to sound so negative, but I mean, there's so many issues I would like to hear more about. I mean, even though they aren't, I mean, one thing, world pollution, world poverty, these civilians that are being, you know, maimed and killed in these horrific, you know, bombings in Iraq and Iran, Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, we're not, I'm sorry, I have to listen to BBC and the nightly news at 5:30 to hear, to me, in depth. I know you're a journalist, but, you know, what is actually going on in the world? You cannot watch CBS, NBC, ABC. They're all the same. They are so polarized and so boring. And honestly, for me, it's propaganda from the U.S. I want to hear the BBC because they go on the scene. You feel what's going on over there, and you get to feel me, the truth, not this glamorized whatever we do over here in the U.S. I'm so sick of it. It makes me ill. Thank you. Sorry about that.
Not a problem. Janice,
well,
thanks for sharing.
Well, another way to look at that in a more positive light is that we now today have access to these international sources in a way that we never did before. For instance, that story about the hotline was from a Times of India article, which would be, in previous eras, a lot harder to access. So I think that for readers looking to go beyond the U.S. perspective and get international news told from the ground, I think that living in the internet age is just a real blessing.
Well, there have been a number of online newspapers, or at least one from India for a long time, because I remember back in the late 90s, I started reading one Indian newspaper, and that was when there were a number of English language papers coming online. There was one in Copenhagen and there elsewhere. When I started reading it was during the Balkan conflict. I wanted to get an opinion from outside the borders of the United States, see what they were saying in Europe, and the internet was a marvelous resource for that. Of course, the BBC has always been kind of the gold standard for international coverage. But the information is out there. You just have to work a little harder to go and get it.
Yeah, exactly. And without the internet, projects like this, the list we put together would be impossible. It's such an amazing resource for finding stories like this.
Was there some reason why you cut it off at 10, and just the symmetry of the thing, or you thought that was just enough?
Well, we chose 10 stories just because it's a top 10 list, but obviously there are dozens more that we could have put on.
Yeah. So how did you determine whether a story was worth putting into the top 10 or not? I mean, I'm assuming you said there were dozens you could have chosen, and what were your criteria? What helped a story make it into the list?
I think generally there are stories that are indicative of a larger trend, that there's a larger issue behind them that we feel hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves. And, things like the red telephone are just indicators of the level of tension that exists in India and China. So we felt that one, for instance, was a good story because it just illustrated this larger point, and the same with the Northeast Passage.
We're talking about 10 stories, top 10 stories you missed in 2009, as compiled by Foreign Policy Magazine. We have the author of the article, Josh Keating, with us by phone. You can join us as well. Maybe you've got an idea for a story that should have made the list. We haven't gone through the whole thing yet, so stick with us. We still have five more to go. And some of these, I think, are extremely interesting, and we'll want to talk about them. We're going to take a short break in just a moment, and when we come back, I know there's some more people lined up on the phone who want to talk about these stories. You could be one of them at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address, if you'd like to reach us that way, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Stories you missed in 2009, these are primarily international stories that you missed, and we're wondering what you think about some of these stories that we've talked about already, and we'll be talking about five more when we come back after this break. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn, today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up next hour. Well, about two dozen states now have in the works or are considering legislation ranging from allowing medical marijuana to decriminalizing the possession of small amounts of pot. After 10, my guests and I will discuss the pros and cons of legalizing marijuana. That should be an interesting hour. Let's continue our list here. We're going through 10 stories you missed. Most of these are international stories. This is as reported in Foreign Policy Magazine. Josh Keating is my guest this hour, associate editor of Foreign Policy Magazine and author of the piece. We are at number 6, the Beijing-Brazil naval access. We don't hear a lot about the People's Liberation Army Navy. Probably if they got a better name for it, we'd know more. But what's going on with the Chinese Navy?
Well, it's been kind of an open secret for several years that China's Navy is developing aircraft carrier capability. They bought several aging Soviet carriers during the 90s. But in order to get this program operational, they need to train their sailors for duties on board an aircraft carrier. And an interesting item that we noticed this week in a report from the Jamestown Foundation was that they reached a deal with Brazil because Brazil has one aging French aircraft carrier. It's about 52 years old. And they're going to be letting Chinese officers train on board the carrier. And it's thought that they're doing this probably in return for restoration of that character, and maybe even some aid to help them build nuclear submarines. And the Brazilians are hoping that this is going to lead to military cooperation in some other areas. And a story that has been well reported this year is the increasing military buildup in Latin America, which Brazil is clearly looking to get in on. And an aircraft carrier capability would definitely help China increase its ability to dominate the sea lanes in East Asia. And it's just a sign that the once unapproachable U.S. naval dominance in that area is starting to slip.
Well, it's an aircraft carrier is how you project power militarily. I mean, that's been the doctrine since World War II. That's how it's done. It used to be the battleship. Now it's the aircraft carrier. I mean, who knows what it'll be 50 years from now. But the Chinese are a little late getting into the game, but they've got a lot of money to spend right now, and it looks like they're really seriously considering building a navy.
Yeah, they do. And officially, the U.S. planners say they're not too worried about it. But if you look at the Pentagon's reports on China's naval capability, you can see that they're actually very concerned about their eroding the eroding U.S. naval dominance there and their ability to the U.S. ability to project force if there were a confrontation in the Taiwan Strait, for example.
Yeah, we don't have the gray ships that we used to have. Not as many of them, certainly.
No, that's true.
Let's see. Well, here's one that's a little bit disturbing. Story number 7: a dead man gets a passport.
Right. So we found this kind of funny and disturbing at the same time. There, since 2007, the U.S. has been issuing these high-tech e-passports, which have biometric data in them and are very hard to forge. Which is all well and good, except it's not very hard to get one. There was a GAO investigation this year where they applied for passports using fake names, including one, they used the Social Security number of a man who died in 1965, and every time they were granted a legitimate U.S. passport.
Ouch. So is something being done to fix that?
Well, the State Department has promised to study the matter, so we'll see what they come out with.
They're going to study the matter.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll go back to the list. We've got three items to go. I want to make sure we get through them all. Just, I don't know, I'm such a linear thinker about this kind of thing. Let's take some more calls, though, because suddenly our phone banks are full. Pat in Oshkosh, you'll be next.
Okay. Good morning, John. Great job on the show.
Thank you.
I think Somali pirates was a story that was reported, about the, you know what I'm talking about, right? Somali pirates.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But the fact, what drove these Somalis to the pirating business was that offshore toxic dumping. Familiar with that story? That angle of it?
Yeah.
Josh, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know as much about the toxic dumping angle, but it is true that there's been all this attention focused on the pirates, but very little on what's driving them. I think that one thing that we need to look at is the instability and lawlessness in Somalia itself, and the kind of and the culture that has led to this piracy.
Pat, what about the offshore toxic dumping? What can you tell us about that?
Oh, I don't know much about that story. Your reader probably knows more than I do.
let's have Pat tell us what he knows. Pat,
well,
are you still
apparently,
there?
Yeah, apparently the lack of government and structure in the country of Somalia has allowed that open sea lane to be exploited for its, you know, for the dumping ability out there. And then these fishermen, or these Somalis that made their living fishing, now found, you know, that there was no fish because of the mass pollution out there.
So who's been doing the dumping?
Well, I don't know. I think international industries of some kind.
Mm. Okay, well, there's something to keep our eye on. Pat, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Brooks in Sheboygan.
Hi. I'd have to agree with the previous caller about the Somali pirates, because that seems like a pretty fascinating story that's been unfolding for years now. But I just want to call about the they're calling it the Climate Gate email, where all the emails were hacked and put into the public domain from the climate scientists and stuff. And I kind of followed it for the first few days, and then I just kind of lost track of it. But I was just curious where that fits in the constellation of interesting stories, because it seems that it's essentially disappeared, or maybe I've just been too busy. But if you could speak to that, that'd be great.
Well, we talked about this about half an hour ago, but Josh, if you want to just repeat, that story got a lot of coverage initially.
Yeah, I do think it got a lot of coverage, and I think that a sign of that was, as I mentioned before, that in the early days of the climate summit, that the organizers were forced to address these emails. So I think maybe it hasn't, that may be one that hasn't gotten that much coverage just because there wasn't that much more to say about it. There was clearly misconduct by these scientists, but I don't think anybody's been able to say definitively that this really disproves climate science as a whole.
Let's go to number 8 on our list here. This is titled Chechen Murders Go Global.
Right. Well, one story that was covered this year was the murder of human rights activist Natalia Yastemirova, and who in Chechnya. But there have actually been a number of opponents of the Chechen president who've been killed this year. His former bodyguard was fatally shot in Austria. A former resistance fighter who was his enemy was killed in Istanbul. And there were several that were killed in Moscow. There was one killed in Dubai. And so this has been a really kind of widespread epidemic of these critics of Kadyrov turning up dead, and it's clearly getting increasingly dangerous to be an opponent of his.
So who's actually doing the killing?
Well, that's not exactly clear. I mean, a lot of these figures were involved in organized crime in their own right, and it's we certainly can't say for sure link it back to Kadyrov, but it certainly does appear that some of these are politically motivated, and this is a strongman ruler who's known for absolute suppression of dissent in his territory, and so it makes sense that it'd be dangerous to cross him.
Let's go next to Ron in West Salem. Oops, I'm sorry. Yeah, let's go to Ron in West Salem. Ron, good morning.
Yeah, why isn't the Tata Nano being manufactured and sold in the United States? I can't get any information on that anywhere.
That's a car that's being made in India.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, it's only been introduced recently, so maybe in the coming years it will be. I'm not sure what the holdup is.
Well, maybe we'll hear more about that in 2010. Richard in Green Bay, you'll be next.
Yes.
Richard, good morning.
Good morning, man. Have you heard of the North American Pact or North American Union, whereby a superhighway is being built now from Canada, across U.S., across Mexico, into Central America? This has been on little blurbs of news. I have heard nothing anywhere about this project. Would you comment?
Well, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. I don't think there's much of it. I mean, there clearly are highway plans to link across the United States, but I think that going as far as to claim that it's a North American Union is a little unfair.
Okay, Richard, thanks for the call. We have time for a few more callers. If you get in right now, it's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. The email address is talk@WPR.org. Number 9 on our list as we close in on number 10, but we're at number 9 now. There's a civil war going on in Uganda, and apparently America has joined in?
Yes, well, this was reported in the New York Times in January. There's a story that the U.S. military had helped plan a Ugandan military attack against this infamous rebel group, the Lord's Resistance Army, which is best known for its taking of child soldiers and sex slaves. But this was the first time that the United States had directly participated in a military action against the LRA, and it went very badly. A number of the rebels were able to escape, and hundreds of civilians were killed. And there was a little bit of talk about this after it happened, but actually now there's a new bill in Congress that would commit the U.S. to eliminating the LRA threat, in the words of the bill, through political, economic, military, and intelligence support. And we just don't think it's gotten the attention that it deserves, that the U.S. is being further committed into a a very messy and very dangerous conflict in southern Africa.
Well, what is what's at stake for the United States in this?
Well, as I mentioned before, this is a really infamous rebel group that has perpetrated numerous atrocities over the years, and the Ugandan government actually has a fair bit of influence in Washington. Their Museveni's government is a longtime ally of the U.S. and has a lot of supporters in Congress. So I think that there is a feeling among several senators and congressmen that there's a need for the U.S. to do more to support that fight, which is certainly understandable. But I do think that there needs to be a little more clarity as to what this help is going to entail.
Okay, let's take a call from Ned in Madison next. Ned, good morning.
Oh, hello. Good morning. I just tuned in, so I'm not sure if you guys covered this one yet or not, but I just wanted to comment on the ongoing fighting in Congo. I think that's sort of an kind of undercovered story. Heard lots about the sexual violence that's going on and things like that. But in terms of current operations, I just got back from 2 years there, and I'm still kind of shocked about, you know, how many people kind of don't even know what's occurring over there.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I mean, this has been an underreported story for many years, and just the sheer level of violence and the number of countries involved, you would think that this would pop up on more radar screens in the U.S., and it's really tragic how little awareness there is of it here.
Ned, thanks thanks for that call and the input this morning. Let's talk about story number 10, because I found this one maybe the most curiously interesting story of the entire group. There is now an ROTC for spies.
Right. Well, this was part of the CIA's appropriation request, which was noticed by Walter Pincus of the Washington Post, who seems to really have a knack for finding these overlooked stories. And the U.S. intelligence community already funds national security studies programs at 14 colleges and universities, but this new program would be a lot more ambitious and would provide financial assistance to students who are studying in areas that would be useful to the intelligence community and would serve in intelligence agencies after they graduated. And what's really interesting in it is that the participation of the individual students in this program would be kept secret. And as you mentioned, it's modeled on the Army's ROTC program.
Well, it was pretty clear that in the 70s and 80s, we went way too far in the direction of technical means for gathering intelligence and really neglected the human intelligence component to the point where there were many areas of the world where we just didn't have any way of finding out what was actually going on other than through phone intercepts and satellite photos and that kind of thing. I guess it makes sense in a way for the CIA to be looking to recruit more people to beef up its human intelligence effort.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that they're looking to increase the diversity of the agency. They're looking for people who speak languages like Arabic, Farsi, and Chinese, and because the CIA has really fallen behind in its language capabilities, and I think that they're looking to increase both the number of analysts who speak a foreign language and those who understand the culture. And for a while now, they've been actively recruiting in Arab American communities towards this end as well.
Let's take one last call from Terrell in Willard.
Yes, good morning. I'm curious about the woman who attacked the Pope, and this being her second time, that nothing's basically they're saying that she's disturbed, but nothing's come out to talk about what is her issue or to investigate that part of it.
Yeah, I really have no idea. I know, as you mentioned, like the man who attacked Silvio Berlusconi a week earlier, she was quickly sort of dismissed as mentally disturbed, and I really don't know much about what her motivation was, and it would be interesting to learn more about that.
Well, speaking of Italy, we had a caller who chimed in that the toxic dumping near Somalia is being done by the Italians. So that question answered.
All right.
Josh, I bet you had a lot of fun putting this list together.
Yeah, it was, and this is the third year I've worked on it, and I think this is probably the best list we've done so far.
Do you think that any of these issues is going to get any traction in the coming year? If there was one that you could pick out that might jump up and start to get more coverage, what would it be?
Well, I think the civilian surge is obviously going to be covered more as the U.S. gets further committed militarily in Afghanistan. And I do think that the increasing competition over resources in the Arctic is, maybe not this year, but in the coming years, is going to be a much more widely covered issue.
Well, note to our crack production staff, I think that Arctic Resources issue might make a good show here in the near future. Thanks, Josh, for joining us this morning. It's been an enjoyable hour.
Thank you so much.
Josh Keating, Associate Editor of Foreign Policy Magazine and author of the piece Top 10 Stories You Missed in 2009. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Erica Janik handled on-air production this morning. If you'd like to listen to it again, go to WPR.org. Go to the Kathleen Dunn page, and you can listen to it all over again. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.